Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov. Welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we bring together national speakers to talk about critical issues in electronic discovery and records management at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and at a time when people are interested in the topic regardless of where they're located, because you can download it and listen to it when you need it. Today we're talking about what I think is an interesting topic, tips for working with a first-time client on an electronic discovery project. Not everyone is a serial e-discovery litigant, and sometimes you have a client who has no idea what they're getting into, and for those of us that have worked in the field, we know it's a little messy sometimes, and so how do you deal with this situation? Do you deal with it, or do you just sail the ship like the captain of the Titanic? So I put this panel of lawyers together because they come from firms which are large enough to get sophisticated electronic discovery cases, but not all of their clients are Fortune 500 type institutions, so my sense is they've got plenty of experience with this topic. The panelists are Monica Lattin, who chairs Dallas, Texas-based Carrington Coleman's business litigation practice. Monica's a frequent speaker on litigation issues. She's actively involved in the working group on electronic document retention and production of the Sedona Conference, and is a member of the advisory board for the Georgetown University eDiscovery Institute. She was also a member of the Sedona Conference Working Group Series on Protective Orders, Confidentiality, and Public Access. Monica handles trials, arbitrations, and appeals throughout the country, including commercial disputes, professional liability, construction litigation, fiduciary obligations, insurance litigation, employment law, and trade secret litigation. She has extensive experience advising clients concerning issues relating to the hiring and departure of employees, including covenants not to compete and misappropriation. Kevin Toner is the chair of Indianapolis, Indiana-based Baker & Daniels Technology Subcommittee. He's one of Baker & Daniels experts on electronic discovery disputes, practices, and procedures. Kevin has created and managed multi-million page document reviews and electronic data production projects, and he's well-versed in computer and internet forensic issues. Kevin has led sensitive internal investigations for large international corporations in the insurance and pharmaceutical industries. He also regularly counsels clients about their document and electronic information retention practices. Kevin's an experienced trial lawyer. He frequently defends premises owners in asbestos personal injury cases. And Kevin has successfully completed lengthy jury trials in Indiana and Illinois personal injury cases. He currently manages clients' defense of hundreds of asbestos cases pending in trial in appellate court in the Midwest. Kevin, glad to have you on the show as well. Greg Krabacher is a Bricker and Eckler attorney based in Columbus, Ohio, practicing in a litigation group. His practice emphasizes intellectual property litigation and prosecution, including representing clients on patent, trademark, copyright, and trade secret matters. He chairs the firm's e-discovery and compliance practice area and is an editor and contributor to the Bricker and Eckler e-disco tech blog and newsletter. Greg's e-discovery practice involves representing clients in discovery disputes, advising clients on their preservation and production obligations, and assisting clients in litigation readiness programs. Greg's a member of the Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production. Prior to becoming an attorney, Greg worked as an information technology consultant with Accenture in Chicago and Atlanta. So a well-rounded group of panelists from all around the country in different practice areas. Why don't we start off, first of all, Monica, then Greg, then Kevin. How did each of you get your start in electronic discovery?
Thanks, Carl. When I was an associate, a partner came into my office and said, hey, I'm starting to see some cases about cost shifting for electronic discovery. Can you look into this and fill us in? I had recently done another project on some changing discovery rules in the state courts in Texas, and I guess between that and having been a computer science major undergrad, I drew the black bean to dig into the issue and figure it out. Ended up, of course, it was in the early stages and not that hard to have an understanding of the lay of the land, but like a lot of things in the law, once you start down a path as the person who knows something about something, you become the go-to person on that, and your experience grows. So the timing was great for me, as what we now call e-discovery was just really getting off the ground. I was fortunate to be able to follow the evolution of the law and the complicated issues associated with that.
Greg, how about yourself?
Well, my story is pretty similar to Monica's, I guess. Perhaps when you
geek
join the law firm with a computer science background, you tend to stick out a little bit. I got strong-armed into it initially by a great mentor here at the firm who was an early and enthusiastic supporter of developing e-discovery procedures for the firm. And when he moved on to start his own e-discovery consultancy, I moved into his role to lead our firm's efforts.
And Kevin?
Well, when I showed up here at Baker & Daniels as a summer associate in 1984, I had an Apple IIc laptop under my arm, and I've always been the one to grab the latest gadget a little before my colleagues here. That caused me to start litigating some software disputes when they came in the door, and it's just been a natural fit ever since. When those geeky kind of issues come up, my phone tends to ring.
But it's such a common theme in the field. So, well, let's jump right into the topic of sort of first-time clients that haven't experienced e-discovery. Monica, you know, what are your biggest challenges in working with new clients in e-discovery? And I'll work around the room or phone line on this one.
Yeah, for me, it's not just dealing with the fact that a client may be new to issues of e-discovery, but typically that client is also new to us as lawyers or as a law firm. And so, like anything else, you're in the get-to-know-you period, kind of like dating, I suppose, and building a trust relationship with the client for some reason has been recommended to you and has decided to hire you, which is great, but they don't really know you. And you want to be careful to build that trust and to come across as a reasonable lawyer who isn't coming in hellfire and brimstone, barking orders about expensive document retention procedures and fancy vendors and huge bills that can follow. So I think a lot of it is a sort of an issue of diplomacy in getting to know your client, getting to know their business, getting to know their personality, and you're happy to have the new client, but you have to act fast. And we all know that you're best served the sooner you can get your arms around not just the electronic evidence, but generally the evidence, getting to know what your case is going to be about and what your strengths and weaknesses are. So you don't want to come on too strong. Clients are all concerned about cost, and some of them have had bad experiences with lawyers that make them skeptical or otherwise suspicious of a lawyer's motive. So that's really the hardest thing, is trying to assess their sophistication and their staffing while getting up to speed on a new case, while dancing that delicate dance of establishing what you hope will be a long relationship of trust and confidence between you.
Kevin, you want to add anything on this? Or?
Well, I share all those perspectives. It certainly, the new client is one issue, but anyone, any client new to litigation or new to litigation with a lot of electronic aspects is going to require some hand-holding and confidence building. The thing I always have to deal with first, I think, as a defense lawyer, are complaints of unfairness. Typically, like in a personal injury case of significance, you have no electronic information on the plaintiff's side of the case and all of the electronic information on the defendant's side of the case. And so the client is understandably going to complain about how unfair this is to have to do all this work solely on our side of the case. And it is a process of building confidence, as Monica just said, to reassure that client that what we're doing is the right thing to do in terms of litigating this case.
Greg, I don't know if you see something different on the patent side, IP litigation.
You know, I would certainly agree with all of those comments. The one thing that I would add is that after, you know, several years of a lot of publicity for e-discovery, more and more clients have either invested in software or they've paid some expensive consultant to come in and set up a process. And that sometimes creates a situation where clients think their situation is better than maybe it is, or maybe they they don't feel the need to examine the issues for the particular case as much. And so in that same very careful diplomacy, you have to sort of assess whether or not they've got a false sense of confidence in their own procedures.
Well, Greg, that leads into the next question about records management readiness. First-time clients, do you see them having typically invested in records management?
You know, our experience, I think, bears out what all the annual surveys tend to show, and that it's just all over the board. Things have gotten better out there, I think, in terms of records management, thanks to some of that publicity. And that certainly helps the discussion. You're not coming into it completely cold. People have heard something about it and a lot of times have taken some proactive steps to put in place a records retention plan or at least feel guilty about the fact that they haven't done it or that they haven't paid as much attention to the one that they do have. And they've also heard something about litigation holds. Our policy is to try to get in there early and have that discussion early so we can understand first what they've got in place and secondly whether or not the needs of the particular case is being met. And I would certainly echo Monica's comments that this is the critical time to build that trust relationship so they know that, you know, you're giving them practical advice that's going to save them money in the long run while achieving their objectives in the litigation as opposed to just, you know, fattening your bill.
Kevin, you had mentioned about the unfairness issue, and I think the question I'm going to ask you about getting a new client to understand the importance of a litigation hold starts sort of that unfairness dialogue. And without going into the lengthy details of litigation holds, we did a nice podcast with John Jablonski totally on that topic. How do you get clients to understand the importance of litigation hold if they've never done this before and preserving broadly?
I think there's nothing better than a scary story. Scary war stories around the campfire have worked for me for ages. And by going through some of the biggies out there who have really been popped with sanctions and spoliation, adverse jury instructions, and even default judgments, is really the best thing to talk about. It happens to Fortune 100 companies who have very elaborate systems because I think the plaintiff's bar has gotten very good at timing the fights over discovery generally and electronic discovery in particular. So I try and walk the client through what is it going to be like in front of the judge if we don't take these steps, and here's some examples of where things went badly for others.
Well, you know, Monica, I mean, all of you have a techie background, but, you know, one of the keys in dialogues in this space is getting access to internal IT people. And is that harder with new clients? Does your background help with that?
Well, I would say I might have a techie background in comparison to some lawyers. But I was a computer science major that went straight to law school. So, and frankly, at least half of what I learned is completely obsolete anymore. I think what my background does for me is maybe make me a little more comfortable in trying to understand the technology issues, but I wouldn't characterize myself as a technology expert. But I think when it comes to dealing with clients, the lawyers have to understand what the rules are, and lawyers have to, in this era, are expected by courts to be proactive in making sure that your clients are aware of their obligations and handling them appropriately. So techie or not, I think you have to project a sense of importance to your client. And just like Kevin said, the scare tactic can be particularly effective. But I think that the issue with getting access to internal IT people, I hit two roadblocks, and not in every case, but some in-house lawyers are protective of access to their business people. In terms of not wanting to bother them taking up their time with litigation or otherwise. I haven't quite figured out why that always is, but they of course want you to go through them, and a lot of times we'll say, well, I'll just go handle that. And so the trick is I think usually when you start asking questions that have a technology bent to them, they quickly realize that it would be easier to hook you directly in with the IT people so you can have a conversation. The second big problem that I see is, and this is probably more common, is whether the IT representatives are receptive to you and appreciate the importance of this issue. And for clients that are new to electronic discovery issues, the IT people usually don't have any idea of what we're asking them to do or why. It's not part of their day-to-day job, which is making sure their technology systems operate properly and don't crash. And so this is a distraction to them, and again, they don't always appreciate the importance of it, so it may not get the priority that it deserves. So getting access to them and then making sure that access is effective, it can be significant challenges.
Carl, can I chime in
sure.
on this?
Mm-hmm.
I think the issue is not just getting to IT people, but getting to the right people, and I think it's the right people for two different roles. One is to actually get the job done and get us the electronic information in a format where we can hold on to it and produce it. And the other is, if there's a fight, who is the right IT person, either in-house or outside, to talk to the court? Because just as lawyers have different levels of comfort with computer technology, the same is true with magistrates and judges. And the lawyer's job is to, themselves and with the right IT person, put things in a story that convince the court in common sense terms that what your client did was reasonable and appropriate. And finding the right person to do that talking is a job in and of itself.
Greg, I just thought of this, but you know, one of the a good friend of mine, Kevin Esposito, used to talk about the challenges of communication between technology people and lawyers and business people. And a key to bridging that gap, I would think, is the ability to speak the same language, especially possibly with a new time client that's never experienced this before in the technology area of a company. Do you find your background is helpful in sort of educating, or is this something that, you know, am I overstating that utility?
You know, I think you do raise a good point. Most IT folks appreciate clear instruction as opposed to something long and flowery like lawyers tend to write. And I guess I would say in my case specifically, I've never had the opportunity to be a truly sheltered programmer. I've always kind of been in the consultancy role, so I've had to deal with a variety of different folks of a variety of different sophistication levels in terms of technology. And I think it does help to communicate separately and differently depending upon who it is you're talking to. The in-house counsel isn't going to understand what a PST file is necessarily, but the IT guy, just, you know, you can just assume that he's going to know or she's going to know what it is that you're talking about, and so you can really cut to the chase. I've certainly had the experience on several occasions that Monica was describing, that initially in-house counsel wants to sort of be the conduit of all communication, usually under the impression that that's going to reduce costs because you'll be, you know, not spending hours and hours talking to a variety of different people, and they can also retain some control. But quickly that, you know, they figure out that they can be more efficient by allowing you to have that direct communication. And that's usually where you get to the right level of information gathering that you need to do your job.
Kevin, you'd mentioned in one of your previous answers about sort of the cost concern of a client, a new client, the unfairness. How do you deal with the cost concern issue?
Well, it's not that different from the cost of litigation generally. You know, it's a management and confidence building issue. Sometimes it's a cash flow issue, but maybe it's my perspective from litigating coverage cases. I also think it's an interesting insurance issue. And what I mean by that is most liability insurance policies are probably not going to cover the good, proactive, get ready for the litigation that's coming down the road business expenses. But they are going to cover the reasonable and necessary expenses of defending the case. The language in the policy probably is also going to exclude work done by in-house folks defending the case. And so there you have, I think, an issue where if there's coverage in place, you may want to use an outside vendor to help you with the electronic chores that are ahead of you in order to take advantage of your client's insurance coverage.
Hmm. Sounds a lot like healthcare.
Yes.
Greg, is it typical for a new client to want to do as much as possible in-house?
You know, I'd say that size is a pretty good predictor of that question. Smaller clients typically don't have experienced resources to devote to litigation, or at least they don't have enough of them to spare. And they tend to, in my experience, they tend to prefer more of a turnkey approach where, you know, we either give them detailed instructions on what to do, or, you know, where we need to image a hard drive or collect a PST file, we send somebody out, whether it's one of our folks or a vendor that we use. Larger clients, you know, again, often have invested in some sort of preparation, hopefully, and they naturally, you know, want to take advantage of that. We try to learn as much about what it is they have in place as early as we can so that we can be sure that that what they've got in place is going to do it. And, you know, I would go back again to the one roadblock you run into is sort of a feeling that, you know, we've already got it covered and we don't need to worry about preservation, or, you know, we don't really need to spend time talking about this. And our position is, well, we need to at least have an initial discussion so we've, you know, we've satisfied our obligations.
Monica, you know, Greg, I think, broke down well the difference between large organizations and small organizations and who has resources to take work in-house. When you're looking at the new client, though, one which hasn't done this before, if you had a large client, say, or any client that wants to take this in-house and they haven't done eDiscover before, does that cause you bigger concerns about changing metadata and authenticity issues with ESI?
Sure. Yeah, I think it has to. Just the same as if a new vendor you've never worked with approaches you about wanting to work with you and you have to evaluate their capabilities. I think you have to do the same thing with a client who says that they want to handle some or all of the e-discovery collection and search and retrieval and review in-house. You know, I think we've all that this is where a lot of the horror stories come from, actually. You know, when clients think they know what they're doing but really aren't handling the data in a forensically sound manner. So, you know, I've seen everything from companies that have their employees just forward relevant, do sort of manual searches and forward relevant emails to some custodian, and then they get printed out and sent to me. That's on one end of the spectrum. And then you have others who really do have IT representatives who know what they're doing, who know how to engage in a proper search under the circumstances, that there's definitely not one size fits all, and to capture the data in a forensically sound manner. So the key is just knowing who you're dealing with, and the courts want outside lawyers to participate in this process, to vet this process, to understand what's happening each step of the way. So I think you do have that concern, but I think that with communication and an advanced conversation about what's going to happen and what processes and procedures are going to be implemented, I think it can work. You know, we've all, frankly, had experiences with vendors who make mistakes or don't handle something quite right. So there's always the possibility that something can go wrong. And the key to surviving the e-discovery process is understanding that it's not ever going to be error-free, but it's whether you approached it in a reasonable manner and in good faith and sort of did your best. And I think that's litigants that can say those things and can satisfy the court of those things are going to get through the process just fine.
That's a good point, that this process is never error-free. So how do you tell a new client, oops, that was perhaps not what we wanted to do, and I'll throw that out to anyone that wants to jump in. Is there an art to it?
I mean, I've had with new clients, especially they just hire you and they want to start sending you information about the case, literally just forwarding emails. They most parties, when something comes along, they've at least gathered some of the key information, and you can tell pretty quickly when they start forwarding emails that they haven't been around the block before when it comes to e-discovery. So, I think that provides you an early opportunity to say, wow, I really appreciate this. This is so helpful to get a sense right away for what the issues are. Let's talk about what we need to do in order to make sure that the electronic evidence is properly preserved and we can produce it and use it in court in a proper manner.
For me, Carl, some of the biggest oopses have been from the large, sophisticated clients, frankly. They tend to have had electronic storage systems in place far longer than smaller, medium-sized businesses. And those have gone through many software iterations and also a lot of staffing changes over the years. So the folks in the IT department who think they know how the legacy systems worked and how things were kept and stored and backed up may not actually know what they're talking about. And you often get disagreements between their view of a legacy system and some expert's view of a legacy system that can take some real time and hair pulling to work through.
Yeah, bigger clients have bigger problems. You're
indeed.
Right.
Indeed. And more systems, you know, from BlackBerry servers all the way through to big mainframes.
It's an ugly rock to lift up. Well, Kevin, then sort of continuing with you, is it, you know, harder to work with a new client in eDiscovery as a team? Given the fact that eDiscovery is hard for everyone, the project manager, regardless of how experienced they are, and the fact that we still have a ways to go to really learn how to manage each other.
Well, we're back to that building confidence thing that Monica started us with. For any new client, the team has to come together and have confidence that we're doing the right thing well and cost effectively. But again, I go back to big versus small. In my experience, the new small, medium-sized business is sometimes more easily convinced to let's bring a vendor in here and take this off your shoulders than the big sophisticated client whose IT department is already stretched trying to take on these litigation responsibilities on top of everything else.
You know, one of the big initiatives in the Sedona conference, which Greg, I know you're involved with, is this year's this cooperation proclamation of not having discovery disputes, but working together to share ESI in a manner that's less adversarial, more getting the heart of the issue. New clients, do you get the sense they're accepting this initiative, or is it still too new to even to talk about?
You know, I don't know if this will come off as a radical statement or not, but when I think about the barriers to cooperation, to me it seems to be more about an issue with the lawyers as opposed to the clients, out of this fear of, well, will my client think that I'm just trying to add in extra things to jack up my bill, or out of this fear that, you know, the client may not like it if we have to do these extra things, I think there's a lot of lawyers still out there who are afraid to raise the issue and afraid to engage in the sort of cooperative activities that can save both parties money. In our case, I think we've been most successful when we've been able to, first of all, demonstrate that, you know, this is standard operating procedure now. This isn't something extra. This isn't optional. This is what you do now because of, you know, the new federal rules, which arguably these duties have always been there, but it's now even more clear. Secondly, we've been successful when we can demonstrate that the client really can save some money in the long run by making some strategic agreements with the other side about, you know, what we're not going to worry about and what we are and how we're going to handle, you know, clawback and how we're going to, whether or not we need to have a special quick peek procedure, you know, any of that kind of stuff. When they can see that they're going to save money and they don't mind saving the money, then that's going to be helpful. I guess a down economy helps there too.
You know, Monica, I also know you're active in the Sedona conference, so if you have any reactions on the cooperation proclamation in real practice.
I agree with Greg. I think that that really lawyers are generally a bigger impediment than clients, and I would add an additional reason that when lawyers start talking to their clients, particularly new clients, about cooperating, they might have concern that the client will think they're soft, and trying to lift up the bed skirts and just, you know, allow the other side to come in and take a look around. And but I think that I agree that most clients, when they understand the benefits of it, that they are willing to go along with the lawyer's recommendation. But I think, yeah, I think the problem is getting lawyers comfortable with the concept, and obviously it takes two to tango. You can't have just one party be cooperative. So you have to be dealing with a reasonable lawyer on the other side who sees the benefits of that as well, particularly in a case where both sides have a significant amount of data in issue.
Good answers there. Hey, I had a thought on this, and sort of I wanted to validate this topic now that we've actually talked about it a little bit. And I'll ask it to you, Kevin, before we go into sort of final tips here. Do you think this is a real issue, you know, the issues that a new client has that's never touched us versus experienced? I mean, we've now had, you know, about 30 minutes or so to talk about this. And, you know, what's your reaction?
Absolutely. Just as clients are new to litigation, even those who've been through litigation that now face big electronic issues in litigation, it's not easy to deal with, and it can really affect the case. One of the things I think a lot of plaintiffs' lawyers have gotten really good at is timing the fights in these cases. You think that you've handled your electronic discovery just fine because the other side hasn't been complaining. And then on the last day of the discovery period, or typically 30 days prior to trial, here come the motions to compel and the motions for sanctions about all the things you didn't do. And it's really hard to convince a court at the last minute that you're squeaky clean. So I tell the new client that's never been through this before, we're going to write everything with an eye towards showing it to the judge and showing that we're reasonable.
Okay. Well, let's go back into sort of, let's sort of end up here with some last tips that you have for new clients, and I guess I'll start with you, Greg, then Monica, then Kevin.
I guess I'll go back to my theme of start early, at least get the discussion going. Every case is different, and so your cookie cutter procedures, no matter how much you spend on them, may not work in this particular case, and so often it's difficult to get a lot of activity early because, you know, everybody thinks that their case is going to settle soon because the other side is just completely, you know, crazy, and clearly we're in the right here. But as time goes on and the case is still around, oftentimes you're more than likely to be glad that you spent the time to get it right up front. It's easier to manage the process early rather than try to repair damage later.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point, Greg, because you get a lot of times, I guess, the client really thinks they're in the right and this is a nuisance suit, and they can get themselves in more trouble by not doing the work you got to do to prepare with e-discovery, right?
Yeah, and I often my answer to that problem is, well, you're right, you know, we've got a great case here, or, you know, if that's accurate. But let's not give the other side, you know, an issue that they can exploit. In the absence of a justifiable claim, they're going to try to create a claim. So let's not give them that. We got to do this in order to take that off the table for them.
Okay. Monica, do you have anything to add in the way of tips?
Yeah, I agree with both of those sets of tips. And I think that the key is just to communicating with your client in an empathetic way, to make sure that they know that you know that this is all so unfair and unfortunate, whether they're the plaintiff who got taken advantage of somehow and has to spend money pursuing this claim, or the defendant who believes it was wrongfully sued, that we understand that this is an unfortunate situation, that we're going to do everything we can to do this in a cost-efficient manner, that there are some basic things that we need to talk about and do, but just verbalizing those things and not just assuming that the client knows that you get it can go a long way towards helping a new client become comfortable with the tasks that you're about to ask them to do.
And Kevin, you got any last thoughts?
Sure.
Always worse to go last.
No. I think my tip for practitioners is to resist the urge to just pull the litigation hold memo out of a form book, but really help your client craft a proper memo from the right person in management to everybody in the organization that looks like you're taking this dispute seriously and really trying to get the right stuff. And then assume that not everybody's going to follow that. Just like the dental hygienist tells us we need to floss more, people need to pay attention to that as the litigation grinds on, and they need to be reminded that there is a hold in place. And that way we can tell the court that we took this seriously and reminded everybody in the organization how important this was.
Well, Monica, Kevin, and Greg, I want to thank you for being my guests here on ESI Bites. I think it's been a good show, and to our listeners, thanks for joining us. For a complete list of shows, visit www.esibites.com. And remember to visit ESI Bites to learn tips about electronic discovery and records management before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov. Have a nice day.